I think we'll get started. Hello, everyone. I'm Jack Cushman, Room Now, and welcome to Tuesday Night Rheumatology. We resurrect the Tuesday Night Rheumatology series after Room Now Live, which we ran at the end of January in this year. And we'll do some replays of the many sessions we had at Room Now Live. Tonight's program is sponsored by AbbVie. AbbVie was one of our prime sponsors for two of our biggest sessions, the rheumatoid arthritis session we're going to review tonight, and then next week, the psoriatic arthritis session. So our thanks to AbbVie in doing that. Tonight, we're going to have some key excerpts from three lectures in our rheumatoid arthritis pod. As you know, Room Now Live has group lectures where we have 3 half-hour lectures followed by a panel discussion. So you'll see roughly 12 to 14 minute excerpts from our three speakers. One, Hani Elgabawi, who is the program chair at the University of Manitoba. Hani's going to talk about prevention of rheumatoid arthritis, something he's spent most of his career working on. Our second lecture is going to be from Dr. Brittany Weber from the Brigham and Women's Hospital. Brittany works in the cardiorheumatology clinic along with Catherine Liao, and they've got a great and interesting perspective on running a cardiac slash rheumatoid clinic, and we'll get some insights from her. And then we'll end with the program chair from UCSD, Dr. Monica Guma, who's going to talk about diet and nutrition in rheumatoid arthritis. So be sure to put your comments in the Q&A session. I'll be monitoring that and we'll be covering that. At the end of the session, we'll actually review some of the questions we sent you in a quiz leading up to this session. And we'll just review that before we sign off at the top of the hour. So let's get started. And I'm going to give our first speaker, Dr. Elgabawi, talking about the prevention of rheumatoid arthritis. Listen up to this.
So this is out of a recent review article, and it really shows you what we're trying to achieve with pharmacologic therapy. You want to treat for a period of time, and then you want to stop. Yeah, and we were discussing earlier on that, so what's the advantage of just treating on and on, which is what we do for RA right now. The advantage of potentially treating at this stage is that you can treat and then stop. And you see in the top in red there, that's the trajectory level of inflammation. What you hope to achieve is during the treatment period, you go down to the green line and it stays that way. Okay, that's prevention. But there's a couple other two other possibilities. One is that people get better during the treatment phase, and then they go back. That's the orange line towards the top red line, and you don't gain much after you follow them. But the other possibility is the yellow line, which is you actually change the severity of the disease, which is an important consideration. We'll come back to that. So these are the studies. They're summarized here. An early study by 15 years ago or more now by the Dutch, where they gave some intramuscular steroid week one or 6 weeks, and then gave or placebo, and their outcome measure is whether there was any 50% reduction in the autoantibody levels. One person with placebo, one person with drug achieved that, but there was actually a reduction in the autoantibody levels, which persisted for up to 6 months. Nobody had RA prevention with a shot of steroids. The PRAIRIE study, 1,000 milligrams of rituximab given and then follow after that for 2 years. There was a delay in the rituximab treated group compared to placebo, but everything looked the same at about 12 months. The TREAT earlier study is one with methotrexate, gave methotrexate 25 milligrams sub-Q weekly for a year and then followed for a year after that. This appears in two places, one in the seropositive, which was the minority of these patients, and one in the seronegative at the bottom there, which was the majority. The inclusion criterion for that is that they had to have MRI inflammation in the joints and the hands and wrists. Two abatacept studies, area out of a German group, treated with sub-Q abatacept for 6 months and then followed them there. The primary criterion was MRI inflammation, which decreased as predicted. But again, they didn't show any difference or not minimal difference after follow-up in terms of the onset of RA. Apipra, which was presented by Andy Cope in San Diego, showed there was more impact on individuals with a fairly significant autoimmunity. And I'll show you a graph of that. But again, the lines came together disappointingly, but perhaps not as much as some of the other studies. And the STOP-RA, which is really disappointing, out of University of Colorado, NIH-funded study, hydroxychloroquine given to people, a third of them with symptoms, two-thirds, excuse me, a third without symptoms, two-thirds with symptoms. It was stopped prematurely because of futility. RA looked like RA onset was the same in placebo and in the hydroxychloroquine group. That was presented in Philadelphia a little over a year ago. So this was the treat earlier, the methotrexate study on the far left. You see how the lines basically come together after the treatment period of 12 months, 24, they're basically the same. But if you look at the high-risk participants in this study, those with a high 70% chance of developing RA, double positive, extensive MRI inflammation, there was nice separation, but again, coming back at while being treated, but coming back together at a year. And then here stratified by ACPA status, and in the red and orange is the ACPA positive, and obviously they develop more rheumatoid arthritis than the individuals who are seronegative. But again, if you look at placebo in that group and placebo in the seronegative group, they come together at the end of 2 years. So this was the silver lining in that study, is that when they looked at HAQ scores, they looked at MRI inflammation at 2 years off of medicine for a year, there was still a no convergence. So the HAQ scores had improved and maintained that improvement, as did the MRI inflammation. So the interpretation was that we may have generated a milder disease, easier to treat disease, which in itself is an important achievement. This is the Apipra study. You can see again coming together, but not completely in the follow-up period. And a point that was made by Dr. Cope and his colleagues is that in people who appeared to have the most severe disease with the most autoantibodies, not maybe not more, most severe, most more autoantibodies, the separation was much better in the follow-up period than individuals who had lower levels of anti-CCP or had less isotypes of autoantibodies. Okay, just a word about the individuals who don't develop inflammatory arthritis. A study looked at that. You're much more likely to continue to have symptoms if you're seropositive compared to seronegative. A third of the individuals had resolution of symptoms, two-thirds did not, and the individuals with no resolution tended to have more pain at baseline, which persisted, and then the MRI resolution happened in both groups. But again, the individuals, some individuals in the no resolution symptom group, simply had symptoms irrespective of what their MRI inflammation showed. Okay, so what would I do? This is just because I'm standing up here. That's that. Based on that evidence, this is what I would do. I would bring her back in 3 months. If she's the same or worse, I'd give her IM steroids and start methotrexate 25 milligrams sub-Q weekly, if well tolerated, less if not. And then if she's asymptomatic at a year, I would taper the methotrexate. That's what the evidence tells me is the right thing to do. Lots of discussion about what about hydroxychloroquine. I think that's the best evidence right now. Okay, second case is one that we got from our own cohort of, we follow indigenous North American first degree relatives of RA patients. We have for 2 decades looking at prospectively at the onset of disease. And this is a woman who was found to be CCP3 positive in the context of the study, first degree relative. She complains of occasional aches and pains, none that persist. no morning stiffness. Mother and sister had seropositive RA, smokes 5 to 10 cigarettes a day. Homemaker, four children, tries to eat natural foods off the land. Exam reveals no tenderness, no swelling, good grip strength. Seropositive for CCP at a good titer 80. Seronegative for rheumatoid factor, normal acute phase reactants. The questions with her, what's her risk of developing classifiable RA and over what time frame? Is there a role for a more advanced biomarker testing, proteomics, immunology, so on? How would you manage her and what are the goals of management? And we'll come back to that. Okay, so what's her risk of developing classifiable RA? And now we are dealing with this part of the graph, which is the more distal from the onset of disease. And here you've got a great heterogeneity. Some people with very early benign autoimmunity, some people with very matured autoimmunity, and it's hard to tell them apart just simply on the basis of their CCP levels. So is there something more we can do? And I will emphasize that this is the population-based approach as opposed to the first case, which is you got the case from a physician's office. So how you get these cases makes a big difference as to what stage they're at. Okay, so on our graph here, this individual belongs on the very top line there in yellow. This is actually made up of our cohort and that of Kevin Dean's and the group at University of Colorado. And you can see here, less than 20% of individuals without arthralgia will develop RA in 5 years, as compared to the red line where the majority will. So this was the design of our study. First, we relatives of RA Provence, so unrelated controls. We assemble this cohort and follow them longitudinally. And we published this a number of years ago. 18 progressors compared those to 356 non-progressors. And I'm just going to point out to you that the progressors were younger. They also had lower BMIs, not higher BMIs, lower BMIs. I don't know whether it's just an idiosyncrasy of our study or not. And nobody had type 2 diabetes, whereas this population has a lot of type 2 diabetes, as you can see in the non-progressors. As you would expect, at baseline, the progressors were much more likely to be autoantibody positive. But you look at the symptoms, we asked them, do you have hand pain, do you have stiffness, so on. You could not tell them apart, the progressors and non-progressors. There's a lot of noise there. And which of this represents clinically suspect arthralgia is an important question. But there was better separation if we looked at HAQ, you know, functional scores, and the ACPA positive first we relative had higher HAQ scores than the ACPA negative, and those scores went up as disease approached in parallel with the increase in the ACPA levels. So when you look at to turn this into cases of inflammatory arthritis for 1,000 person years of follow-up, it's four for the double negative at baseline and the double positive at baseline, it's almost 100. So 10% of these people a year will develop inflammatory arthritis if you're double positive. But I show you this, and this was a surprise to us, which is if you take any individual at any one time point with their state, let's say double positive, ACPA positive, what's their likelihood of being in the same state next time you see them? And so you become seronegative or seropositive and so on. I'm just going to get you to focus on the bottom line there. After 5 years with baseline double positive, 40% will have developed RA, 40% will have reverted to a seronegative state. This is not a one-way street. We were surprised to see that, but that's what our data show. I propose that the maturation of the autoimmunity is the point of no return. And how can we tell that this autoimmune response is being matured? Here you see in the middle bar there, one individual at baseline, each one of those little columns in there represents a visit. And on the far right is an autoantigen matrix done by Bill Robinson at Stanford, multiple citrullinated endogenous autoantigens, clustrin, fibrinogen, bimentin, so on. And as you can see at RA onset, there's a dramatic increase in the amount of red compared to baseline. This is the phenomenon of epitope spreading, which the immune system does for a living. And if you convert that to a score, You can see here the important take-home point is that increasing anti-CCP levels is an indicator of increasing epitope spreading, more endogenous autoantigens, not just an increase in one specificity. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this, but the glycosylation state of the ACPA is very interesting, both in the FC, which the
Okay. So thank you, Hani. We're going to move on to our second speaker from the cardio rheumatology clinic at the Brigham and Women's Hospital, Dr. Brittany Weber. And we'll join her in the middle of her lecture. She will have gone through some of the advances in imaging that have taken over cardiology and the assessment of patients and how that's now being applied to rheumatology patients. Dr. Weber.
And taking a step back, as a cardiologist who trained in rheumatology with a passion in cardiorheumatology moving forward, everything has changed in the cardiovascular community. The most groundbreaking trial was in 2017, led by Dr. Ricker, that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine, which was the first in the proof of concept study demonstrating that taking patients with known cardiovascular disease and treating them with an anti-IL-1 inhibitor, canakinumab, which blocks IL-1 beta, led to a reduction in cardiovascular events, which was really a truly groundbreaking trial given that proof of concept. More recently, we've had a number of studies that have shown the strong benefit of colchicine, a therapy that you're probably very well familiar with and have utilized a lot in terms of different conditions, gout, pericarditis in your own practice. But this has demonstrated dramatic risk reduction in patients with both acute events as well as stable coronary disease. And this mounting evidence for colchicine, which is easy to implement, actually led in 2023 the FDA to approve colchicine, which is really remarkable. This is the first anti-inflammatory drug in cardiology for reducing cardiovascular events. So we are at exciting times. And now I want to transition to talk a little bit about some of the common diseases we all study, but then I'm going to really walk through some cases of rheumatoid arthritis to really try to hone in these points of how we can identify cardiac risks and particularly how we can utilize imaging. So we all know that systemic lupus erythematosus is one of the common systemic inflammatory disorders that can predominantly affect young women, and it's associated with an increased risk of cardiovascular disease. There's a range of cardiovascular manifestations, but one of the most significant, of course, is accelerated atherosclerosis. And so we know from prior literature that among patients that are asymptomatic, patients with lupus have much higher rates of plaque, so atherosclerosis detected by CT in all age groups. This was really a seminal paper published in the New England Journal of Medicine now 20 years ago or 21 years ago. And you can see that this problem persists in our patients with lupus. Going back to some of the older data, when we look at the Framingham Offspring study, you can see when you take those young patients with lupus, they have up to a 50-fold increased risk of myocardial infarction compared to healthy individuals in a cohort study, really demonstrating that we have unrecognized need here for improving cardiovascular outcomes in our lupus patients. Psoriasis is another important and very common condition, and one that we also study back here in Boston to try to understand how we can better reduce cardiovascular disease. Psoriasis and psoriatic arthritis is a chronic autoimmune inflammatory disease. It's common. It affects up to 3% of the population. And as you all know, up to one-third of these patients also have concurrent psoriatic arthritis, which is where you would be predominantly taking care of these patients. And at this point, it is well established that psoriasis is associated with an increased risk of cardiovascular disease and an increased prevalence of cardiovascular risk factors. This is just showing a very seminal figure in the field, again, back in 2006 in JAMA, led by Dr. Gelfand at the University of Pennsylvania, where he shows the relationship between the age and the severity of psoriasis and the risk of myocardial infarction. And I want to just clue you into the left of the chart. Look at the patients between 20 to 50 and look at the increased risk a patient with severe skin disease over mild skin disease has. And this really highlights the importance of inflammation and that this is indeed more than just skin deep. Third, I'm going to talk that we're going to be discussing rheumatoid arthritis, which is really where I want to be discussing the majority of my talk today, to really hope to provide some insights into really what we're trying to understand by using rheumatoid arthritis. And so we all know it's a very common systemic inflammatory disorder that predominantly affects the joints. And at this point, again, well established that these patients have increased risk. And if we just look objectively at the data, RA patients have about 1.5-fold excess risk of CDD when we compare them to age, sex, matched individuals from the general population. And we believe this excess risk is attributed to that inflammation. And so we can think of RA as an independent CV risk factor and utilize RA as a human model of inflammation. And this is just work from our own institution. We have a longitudinal study at the Brigham and Women's Hospital called GRAPH. And this is showing that our RA patients and their mean level of CRP compared to the general population, and where we think about CRP cutoff for the general population, you can see here that our RA patients live at much higher levels of systemic inflammation. And particularly about RA, we are really starting to understand more and more the disease mechanisms of in these shared pathways. This is a recent review where Dr. Liao and I at the Brigham, really, and Dr. Giles as well, really try to decipher this and discuss the key shared mechanistic pathways. So you can see here a joint, which we all know well in rheumatology. And on the right, we can see here the atherosclerotic artery. And if we think about all these factors in atherosclerosis and the synovium and the joint, we can see that there really are these shared pathways that are starting to diverge. And we're arguing, or we're proposing here, that it really seems to be pointing down this IL-1, IL-6 TNF pathway. And importantly, you all know that these are common treatments we utilize for rheumatoid arthritis. And in fact, we are now testing these for general cardiovascular diseases, which are very exciting. So I'm now going to transition to a case. We're going to walk through two cases to try to highlight how we can be identifying cardiovascular risk and, importantly, how imaging can help us. And so my first case is a patient that I've been seeing now for well over 4 years. She's a 45-year-old female. She's got rheumatoid arthritis, and she presented with subacute worsening of shortness of breath and atypical chest pain. Here is her rheumatoid arthritis history. She was diagnosed 2 years ago and started on methotrexate, but she was still having active disease. So the next line of therapy was to add a TNF inhibitor. And at that point, she actually entered into a study at our institution, which involved a myocardial perfusion test. And so I'll show you that on the next slide. But let's talk about her cardiac history prior to that. Well, she really had no known cardiovascular risk factors. She was premenopausal, and she did have hyperlipidemia that was untreated. She didn't know this, and this was her lipids here when I met her, but you can see this was untreated hyperlipidemia as a risk factor. Here's her CRP when I met her. And importantly, what was her risk score when we put her into the standard 10-year ASCVD calculator that we all utilize in cardiology? 1.1%, so low risk. Here I'm showing her cardiac perfusion PET, and I'm not going to go through the nuances of how to read a perfusion PET, although it is a very cool imaging modality, but I want to highlight here that we stress images on the top, resting images on the bottom. And the result of the scan showed a medium-sized area of moderate ischemia in the LAD territory. It also demonstrated normal global LV systolic function, but clearly a very abnormal result for a patient who's 45 and otherwise young and healthy, free of cardiovascular disease. So let's talk a little bit about PET and why I really think this is an important modality for us to really understand patients' risk. And the reason is that it provides a lot of imaging information. This test may not be available at every institution, but when it is available, it really does provide a comprehensive assessment of both the anatomy and the functioning across coronary artery disease. So I just showed you the perfusion images. So this is looking for like an epicardial or a blockage. So that's focal disease. But look what else we get. We also get the atherosclerotic burden, because you get a calcium score with your chest CT that you need for a PET scan. You can get LV function and volumes with the gated material here. And most importantly is the bottom right. You get the myocardial blood flow. And this myocardial blood flow allows us to detect microvascular dysfunction. This is not something that can be detected by the other imaging modalities you saw or by invasive coronary angiography unless you were undergo specific microvascular testing. And this remains the gold standard for coronary microvascular dysfunction. So how do we actually understand and think about coronary microvascular dysfunction? Well, we utilize a term called the coronary flow reserve. And I want to tell you what this is. This is an integrated hemodynamic measure. So it's going to incorporate epicardial. So if you were to have a blockage, diffuse atherosclerosis, vessel remodeling, and myocardial tissue dysfunction on tissue perfusion. So if you we know from the perfusion images there's no focal defect, then we can utilize the coronary flow reserve as a surrogate of microvascular function. How do we calculate this? Where patients undergo two different sets of pictures and we vasodilate the arteries to mimic as if you were exercising. And that's your myocardial blood flow at peak stress. And we divide that over the myocardial blood flow at resting. And what's a typical value? Well, this has been validated by Dr. DeCarli, my mentor who I trained with and continue to work with, and multiple others. And in the established literature for clinical purposes, we utilize the coronary flow reserve as two as the normal cutoff. And when I say the normal cutoff for where risk starts to become highly important. So this is showing you an important study in the circulation now, actually 10 years ago, led by Dr. DeCarli group here at the Brigham that demonstrated with a coronary flow reserve of two, how much increased risk it makes you have when that coronary flow reserve falls below that, and that is equal between male and females. But this is for the general population. And so when I first started out in my scientific pursuits, we actually wanted to investigate whether this as a risk marker was similar prognostic in our rheumatology patients. And one may say it may not have the same predictive ability because our patients are at varied levels of disease activity and states of inflammation. And that led to a study that we led, as well as another study that had complementary data at the same time that looked at this question to say, is coronary microvascular dysfunction prognostic in our patients with rheumatologic disorders? Shown here is all-cause mortality from data from our own institution that looked at rheumatoid arthritis, lupus, and psoriatic disease. And we demonstrated the similar prognostic importance. The same figure on the right by the group at Yale also looked across different inflammatory disease conditions shown here on the bottom right panel. You can see they also included a small number of Sjogren's and scleroderma patients, and again saw dramatic risk increases with patients with low coronary flow reserve. So I just went through this whole thing telling you about coronary flow reserve, but let's go back to my patient, right? I was telling you that I met this patient. Well, what was her myocardial blood flow? I haven't given you that data yet, so let's go back. So here's her data. So the way we look at these, and these are reported clinically in PET reports, is we have the stress blood flow, the rest, and the flow reserve. You can see here it's for all three coronary arteries, and we average. And her result led to a CFR of 1.9. So that is below two. Highly abnormal for a patient who's 45 female without cardiovascular risk factors. So I've seen her in clinic. So this is, I am her cardiologist. So what did I do? Well, remember, she still had that LAD ischemia on the stress test. So we really wanted to make sure that we weren't dealing with a large blockage causing this reduction of blood flow. So we ordered a coronary CT to provide this data. And here I'm showing you her images here. And what these data demonstrated is that she had diffuse plaque. So she had no kind of critical blockage, but what she did have is she had diffuse plaque of all three coronary arteries. The predominant was non-calcified because she's 45 and young, and we know that calcified plaque takes time, so it's more common as you age, so that's another learning point. But she had really extensive atherosclerosis for her young age without cardiovascular risk factors. So again, let's take a step back here because I showed you on that first slide that her 10-year estimated risk was 1.1%. So no guidelines would have ever said this is a patient you should be initiating therapies and talking about cardiac risk. And let's just walk through here. So let's go through the exercise of utilizing our standard cardiovascular risk calculator. So here's our traditional cardiovascular risk factors. All she had was dyslipidemia that was diagnosed when we met her in clinic. Otherwise, she was negative for all these other risk factors. Here I'm showing you the 10-year ASCVD calculator that many of you may also know and go to the website or have programs that integrate this into your electronic medical record system. But you can see her risk comes up at 1.1%. And to just remind everyone, our primary prevention cardiovascular guidelines, the way we think about how to initiate prevention therapy is based on their level of risk. So this is just walking through it. It's a complicated figure. The reference is here. But I just want to highlight the notion that the level of risk that we start to think about initiating statin and prevention therapies is generally a risk of 7.5 and greater, or there is the borderline risk, this 5 and 7.5, where we utilize risk enhancers. And everything else is where we're really emphasizing lifestyle. What are the risk enhancers? And this is an important learning point today, is that these are the listed ACC, AHA risk enhancers that are in our guidelines. And in the 2019 update, I was so excited because they added inflammatory diseases. So now it is recognized as a risk factor. And this is because we have tried, there are multiple disease-specific calculators out there, right? We've tried this for rheumatoid arthritis, and they may perform better in some cohorts, but not all. And that is why we probably all know and can appreciate here that these risk scores really underestimate risk in our patients. So we have to get better. And so let's just make sure I hone in on the key points here is that the 2019 update, inflammatory diseases is now a risk enhancer, so you can utilize that in your clinical practice. So let's summarize this case. So what is, you know, how do we treat her? So we have a 45-year-old female with active RA. She's got now non-obstructive coronary disease and significant microvascular dysfunction. So she was started on aspirin, statin, a beta blocker because of her symptoms of dyspnea and chest pain. And we discussed diet, lifestyle modifications, and her rheumatologist first initiated a TNF inhibitor, certolizumab. However, she did great for a couple years. And as we all know can happen, her disease became active again. And she now has switched to a JAK inhibitor, and she has excellent control of her RA disease activity, which we don't have time to discuss in this short break today, but I know we're all very well of the JAK inhibitor data and all the subsequent data that has come out of this after the oral surveillance. But I did just want to highlight that this is a common thing I see in the cardio.
So thank you, Dr. Weber, for that really interesting discussion about how they are assessing their patients and what she's relying on. And I think it kind of underscores maybe that we need to do some of what she's doing. It'd be nice if we had the ability to have cooperative care and to probably have a low threshold to refer patients to cardiology for co-management. I want to remind you can put any questions you may have. We'll get to those at the end. We have one more address from Dr. Monica Guma from UCSD, where she's going to talk about diet. Now, she starts out by reviewing the ACR guidelines on diet in rheumatoid arthritis and shows a lot of evidence in favor of the Mediterranean diet. And then she's going to talk about the anti-inflammatory diet, or the ITIS, I-T-I-S, later on in this next 12 to 13 minute segment. So let's transfer over to Dr. Guma's presentation.
Dietary supplements, but it doesn't mean that there are no studies with the other diets. There are a lot of studies with vegan diet, anti-inflammatory diet, exclusion, and these guidelines, they have a very long appendix, but if you are interested, it's worth taking a look, because you go there and you can see how they couldn't really choose those diets because the bias. There is a few studies, no, with a vegan diet, for instance, that they are good, but then there is some publication bias, or there is some inconsistencies that they make that that trial not suitable for recommendations. So we need more research. There probably are other diets that can help our patients. But as of now, we have the MET diet as a recommendation from the ACR in RA. So one of the studies that they, I mean, I think is a good study to take a look is in the MET diet out of the four. This one was the one with a better, or with less bias. So they concluded that this is a very good study, And they took a few patients, 25 to 25, one met diet, another arm was control. And just to emphasize, all these studies, the patients have activity, but they continue the standard of care treatment. They are all following methotrexate or toxazine or other cardiologics. So the idea with the diet is always a complement. So is when the patient is the standard of care and they still ask you for help, and they ask you that they would like to take, I don't know, less NSAIDs, no? Like if there is anything to help, is when you start a conversation with diet about diet. And that's what they did in this trial. They continued standard of care and they added the diet. And you can see in the graph that that both arms at the beginning get better, probably because of the placebo is very strong in the diet trials, but then later the arm, the med diet continues like a decreasing in both of us and DAS, but the control stays like a steady. So I don't have pointed here, so I cannot point, but anyway, you can see the graphs that the upper one and the lower is VAS and DAS, how the med diet continues decreasing and the control diet stays. So this is a good trial if you are interested in reading. This is 2003, so we already know that the med diet is good. And the med diet is also very good for cardiovascular risks. That really like, links very well with the last talk. Of course, we need to stratify the patients. Of course, we need to go into those tests that our colleague explained in the other talk. But we know, we do know the med diet is really good for cardiovascular prevention and to help that comorbidity as well. So I think that we have enough evidence to explain our patients this and to recommend med diet for our patients. So some of you in the audience, you may maybe follow our research at UCSD. We are really interested in understanding if maybe a more like an anti-inflammatory diet can help. And anti-inflammatory diet is basically, most of them are based on med diet. So you already have the med diet as a baseline, but then you try to include other ingredients that they are like known to be anti-inflammatory. And we try to also to do it like a culturally sensitive, means that depending on your like a population, med diet is quite like a general, but if you start like adding ingredients, depending on your population, some people, they may not like that ingredient, or they don't even know how to cook that ingredient, how to buy that ingredient, where to buy that ingredient. So we try to put like a diet that in our population in San Diego, it was really well established, well followed, the adherence was really good. And we are trying to understand if this diet, that it would be again a med diet, but with a kind of like a booster with more anti-inflammatory ingredients like a, I don't know, curcuma, turmeric, miso, like we really add a few ingredients that probably helps and helps the inflammation a bit better. So this is only like a preliminary data, is still a pilot trial. We took a few patients, 20, 25 patients. We put them all on this anti-inflammatory diet. And what we saw is that all the parameters are really very quick, in 2 or 3 weeks, the patients, they felt much better. Our research really goes, I'll go now to talk about the microbiome, is because, as you know, it's the same as with the medication. Not all the patients, they respond at the same extent.
I'm going to pause for a second just to underscore what she was saying with the anti-inflammatory. She says the same as the med diet, the Mediterranean diet. The differences are maybe in some of the foodstuffs. You know, an anti-inflammatory diet is low in gluten, no gluten, or and very, very low in refined processed carbohydrates. They make it further anti-inflammatory, she said, by adding in curcumin or turmeric, that sort of thing. So, and now she's going to start to talk about the effects of diet and how it achieves these clinical outcomes and talk about the microbiome as one of the factors. So I'm going to resume.
Then we can blame the physiopathogenesis, the pathway that is activated in those patients. But overall, we know that some of the patients will respond really well. Some of the patients, they will not respond so well. With the diet trials, it's also the same. Overall, we always have a very good response. Of course, we have the placebo here. We need a randomized trial. But the important thing is that some patients, they do respond very well. Really, in 1 or 2 weeks, they start feeling the effects. And some patients, they don't, or they need more time. So that's also part of the understanding of how diet actually works. And I hope to have really soon more results about the randomized clinical trial that we're doing between med diet versus this anti-inflammatory diet. So we have med diet as a baseline, kind of like a healthy diet, and then we compare with this ITIS diet. And this all these dots is because we really want to understand the mechanism. So we are collecting to get data about microbiome, metabolites, and try to understand the reason why patients, they respond really dramatically and very well and very soon, and some patients, they don't. But as of now, I recommend you to, if for any patient that asks you for diet, to ask, what can I do? I really want to change my diet. Can I get some help? To direct them to the Arthritis Foundation website. They have a very very nice few pages about diet, about med diet, ingredients, ingredients they should, that you should not take, the ones that they cannot, that are good for follow a med diet, very useful. Generally, we don't have time to talk about diet in our clinic because we are like stressing the side effects of methotrexate and other drugs. But just like directing them to the this Arthritis Foundation website is very helpful, and they can come back with questions. If the patient has a good insurance, they probably will be able to go to the dietitian at least 2 or 3 times. Just tell them to get this feedback about med diet. So really very helpful, and the patients appreciate that you are actually telling them something that they actually can do. So the last like 12 minutes, I really want to try to explain why changing diet actually helps, and a little bit the mechanism that some groups were trying to dissect. No, and first a question: no, how does the Mediterranean diet affect inflammation? No, we know that patients to change the diet, we really have to go from low vegetables in the Western diet to more vegetables, more fruit, less meat. Less processed foods, but why? Why do you have to change that? So the last question for the pool is, how does the Mediterranean diet affect inflammation? One is maintaining like a healthy microbiome, enhancing the production of anti-inflammatory metabolites, maintaining the intestinal barrier integrity, or all of the above. Okay, let's take a look. Yeah, all of the above. As we know how to take tests. No, you have the all the above option is all of the above. It's true. We have that kind of like a explanation for the diet, and we'll go a little bit over those options. No, and I think these are maybe like a very busy slide, but I think it's very, very informative. And you have in one side the med diet, in the other side the Western diet. And I think the important thing here to understand is that the ingredients are not just to be metabolized and get the lipids, the carbohydrates, the proteins, to get energy and to really to be our like a font of like a basically energy. The most important thing here to understand is that all these ingredients are going to be metabolized, and that would help to create a healthy microbiome or a more unhealthy microbiome in our gut. We'll go now later to talk about a little bit about microbiome. It's not so easy. It's of course not only diet, but the diet is one of the traits that is going to help to shape the microbiome. And depending on the microbiome that you have in your gut, that is going to be very important to select different metabolites that are going to be both in the gut, but also circulating, and that can help to shape the inflammation. So basically, the research in this field is trying to dissect the different ingredients, the different micronutrients, and they try to understand what type of diet, what type of like an ingredient is shaping more or less the microbiome. And then when you shape the microbiome, what are the metabolites that you have after this interaction between diet and microbiome? Those metabolites will be probably important to shape the inflammation to a more pro or anti-inflammatory pool of metabolites. When you have the Western diet, different ingredients, different food, different shape of the microbiome, different pool of metabolites. So sometimes it's as simple as that, is the interaction between the diet, microbiome, then you have a different pool of metabolites. And this is another like a way to see that. You have in the top the different ingredients, and you have the gut microbiome. It's going to be different among ourselves, but also among the patients. They will have different degree of what is called dysbiosis, no? Different degree of abnormal microbiome. And that will be the interaction between what you eat and the difference of our microbiome dysbiosis. You will have a different pool of metabolites. Some of them are good, like a short-chain fatty acids. Some of them are considered pro-inflammatory, like a TMA. And then you will have a local effect in the gut barrier, but you also, because they will be absorbed, you can also have more like a systemic effect. And that's how the MET diets and other ingredients, they will decrease the oxidative stress, they will like decrease the weight, blood pressure, blood glucose. But in our case, what is important is that they will decrease the inflammation. So just a couple of like a 1 minute to talk about.
Okay, we're gonna resume. She was gonna go into a much deeper discussion of microbiome. I think you understand the points that she's making, that the microbiome is one of the targets of dietary intervention, and that is one of several reasons why people do better with diet. Really well shown that dietary intervention and weight loss has major effects on psoriatic arthritis, but it's also been shown in rheumatoid arthritis. So I thought that was a very interesting, and actually Catherine Dow wrote about this yesterday in Room Now, if you want to get another synopsis of what Dr. Guma has covered. Let's go over two questions and then end with some quiz questions. I think this first question actually is the reduction, is there a reduction in RF and CCP important? And what is the role of memory B cells? You're talking about, again, what was covered by Hani El-Ghabawi, where he's talking about clinically suspect arthritis patients who may progress. And clearly, the antibodies are important. If you don't have the antibodies, then there's no risk. Antibodies alone, he said, the risk is 20%. Antibodies plus more, it goes up higher, as much as 50% or more. But then the big point that he wanted to make was, as RF and CCP and other multiple order antibodies increase in number of different order antibodies and increase in titers, you get more epitope spreading and more complexity. It's going to lead to RA. But when you don't get that, he showed you 40% of patients went on to develop, who were seropositive, went on to develop RA, but 40% of those people who they were following turned seronegative and they didn't develop RA. So clearly, the antibodies are important. So, in addition to traditional risk factors and inflammation reduction, exercise may accelerate CAD. Reduction in exercise may accelerate CAD. One important question is why JAK inhibitors may increase CAD and should be given cautiously. This is a complex issue. We've covered it before. The bottom line here is you can look at the data from the oral surveillance and say that JAK inhibitors have more cardiovascular events than do TNF inhibitors. But it's very prudent, if not wiser, to look at the data differently. and know that TNF inhibitors have been shown repeatedly to lower cardiovascular risk. And in this study, they just showed that TNF inhibitors were better at lowering cardiovascular risk than were JAK inhibitors. Statistically significant, clinically meaningful, well, only for those people who are older than 65, smoking with a cardiovascular history of MI. That's where it became clinically meaningful. So I don't know that, I think you have to go with the guidelines and say you got to use a TNF inhibitor before you use a JAK and have some caution if using JAKs in people at risk, especially older than 65, prior MI, current smokers. Yeah, maybe that JAK is not your first, second, third choice. So I think that's where we handle that. And then the last question, in my country, most patients believe in what is called foods with warm nature, ginger and turmeric, decrease pain and stiffness. Sure. And they feel worse by eating milk, by drinking milk. You know, dairy intervention and elimination diets haven't really proven to be very effective. Certain things like ginger, turmeric, curcumin, berries have proven to be anti-inflammatory in some diets and in some clinical situations. So that's worth, I think, paying attention to. I want to end, if there are no more questions, I want to end by showing you what we'll be doing next week and covering some of the questions that we gave you in the survey leading up to today's program. So you can see that throughout April, this is April 2nd, we covered RA. Next week, AbbVie is the sponsor of a psoriatic arthritis session where we're going to have three really interesting lectures. Alexis Ogbe talking about the guidelines for psoriatic arthritis. April Armstrong, a powerhouse dermatologist who does all the clinical trials from UCLA, talking about choosing systemic therapies for psoriasis. And this lecture by Leahy Eder from the University of Toronto on gender differences and PSA outcomes, oh my God. I think it's the best lecture I've heard all year. We're going to show you an excerpt of that next week. In the weeks to come, we'll be talking about vasculitis on the 16th, spondyloarthritis on the 23rd, and then lupus on the 30th. During this week, this is our RA week. Next week is PSA week. You'll see a lot of content that we generated in Room Now Live in the way of tweets and written articles and some videos. And then, of course, this Tuesday night rheumatology that you'll see displayed all week in addition to our usual content. Let me end by showing you the results of the survey that we sent out yesterday. 208 of you responded to the survey. If you were a registrant at Room Now Live, you would have received a bunch of review questions. We call them board questions. They're more like review questions. About 170 of them on those topics I just mentioned, RA, PSA, SPA, whatever. That's one of the benefits of registering for Room Now Live. So let's go over to some of these questions. First question that you saw, what is the frequency of cardiovascular disease in RA compared to the general population? And you heard Brittany Weber address this. The number is 1.5 times that of the general population. And that's the green. That means that 33% of you got that right. Kind of a hard question that I wouldn't have thought. I would have guessed two times based on some graphs I've seen in the past. So I think I would have been with you on that. But the right answer is 1.5 times, or a 50% increase. Second question, which imaging tool is getting expanded use in assessing microvascular function of in patients with cardiovascular disease? Dr. Weber went over this and was pretty excited about the use of UCHO's coronary CT angiography. But the right answer is this blue, 26% of you got it right, stress PET scanning. That's getting wider use amongst cardiologists, especially at academic centers where they have that tool. The third question that Dr. Weber did cover, in 2023, the FDA approved which rheumatologic drug specifically for the treatment of cardiovascular diseases. And you all got that right. Almost 80% of you chose colchicine. Rilonacept was approved in 2022 for the treatment of recurrent pericarditis. That's an IL-1 inhibitor. And as you know, febuxostat and tofacitinib have their FDA and package insert warnings about cardiovascular risk, so that's not an indication. Question number four, ACR guidelines for dietary interventions in RA recommend, and you all got it right. Over 80% of you said Mediterranean diet, and you were correct. Number five, the next 2 years, what percentage of seropositive, clinically suspect arthralgia patients will develop RA, classifiable RA? And I think you got the answer right. The answer that you chose was about 30%, and 52% of you have chose that. And that's what I've been saying, and that's what the data is very clear about. What Dr. El-Ghabaloui showed was that 20 was 50%, which is what 20% of you got right. But it does say basically that there is some number, and it's a healthy number, that it goes up first with being seropositive. It goes up more with multiple seropositivity. It goes up with high titer double seropositivity. And then you add on, when you start getting more symptoms, when you start getting more signs of inflammation, the risk goes up and you start ratcheting closer and closer to a higher risk of developing RA. Question number six, recent proof of concept trial suggests which treatment during the arthralgia phase of pre-RA could prevent or delay the development. And I think the majority of you got that right. 60% chose the right answer, abatacept. Methotrexate, while Hani actually chose methotrexate for his patient who was at risk, I want to remind you, the Treat RA trial primary endpoint was a development of RA, and it showed no difference. It showed some subset differences in HAQ, right, in pain and whatnot, but in the primary endpoint, developing RA was no difference. So this is quite controversial. Clearly, hydroxychloroquine is not the way to go. Colchicine has never been tested as a intervention in preclinical RA. Okay, the last two questions were pretty simple. Taken from the year before, hydroxychloroquine should be discontinued during pregnancy and breastfeeding. Obviously, you all said that's false, and that is correct. You should safely continue hydroxychloroquine because there's many, many benefits. And the last question was, hydroxychloroquine is FDA approved for use in lupus, RA, discoid lupus, or all the above, and almost 80% of you chose all the above, and that's the correct answer. Hydroxychloroquine is also FDA approved for the treatment of four different forms of malaria. And there are warnings in there about using hydroxychloroquine in chloroquine-resistant areas, or in treatment-resistant malaria, et cetera. It may not work all that well. So I want to remind you, tune in next week. We'll send out another invitation to attend the psoriatic arthritis Hot Topics review. I think you'll find that session to be really interesting. I hope you have a good evening, and thanks for attending tonight's Tuesday Night Rheumatology. And thank your local AbbVie rep for sponsoring this. Take care.